This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
In some groups on the streets with sticks and knives trying to attack the demonstrators. And yesterday, again, as according to the Bar Association, nearly 400 people were detained. But the problem is there is no real numbers, so they only get news by phones and by interviewing people. So we don't know the exact numbers, and we don't know the names of the people who were detained. Well, that's the situation in short.
Cheetah Mosturk, we just have about 30 seconds. Independent journalists also speaking to us from Istanbul and from Express Magazine. The significance of where these protests go from here?
Well, actually, see what's going to happen. The main problem is the governor, the political parties are not so in the protest. What I mean by the political parties is only the justice and development parties in the protest. The least is the people, I would say. I mean, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, the prime minister, is naming the protesters as some looters and some, you know, terrorists. But anyway, these are people. Just a part of it is some organizations.
Cheetah Mosturk and Nazan Öztuntag, we're going to have to leave it there. I thank you both very much for being with us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8:01. Coming up next is More Talk Radio with hosts Cecil Prescott and Celeste Carey. Today's guest is Assistant Professor of History at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, Greg Carter, author of the new book, The United States of the United Races, A Utopian History of Racial Mixing.
Station Navigator Report, June 14, 2013. Recently, I announced a renewed effort to both survey the community to better understand what they want and need from their community radio station and to recruit many more financially supporting and voting members. Today, we launched the first survey in this campaign. True to KBOO's mandate to serve the underserved, and knowing that thousands in the greater Portland metro area have no access to progressive talk radio since the demise of KPOJ last winter, we are asking the question, would you like to hear the Tom Hartman Show Monday through Friday on KBOO? What does this mean in terms of airtime to meet the needs of the outcast liberal progressives in Portland? 15 hours out of the 168 hours, KBOO is on the air each week. Please go to kboo.fm and look for Tom Hartman on KBOO, then take this two-question survey. If you are not currently a member, please join us today. Pass the link along to others. We need to hear from the entire community if we are to make informed decisions. Please understand that this is only an informational gathering survey to guide possible future programming changes. Please contact me if you have questions or concern. My door is always open. This has been KBOO Station Manager, Development Director, Executive Director, and Ever Watchful Navigator, Lynn Fitch. Thanks.
Wisdom of the Elders is committed to Native American cultural sustainability, multimedia education, and reconciliation. It especially seeks to correct misconceptions and prejudice, to bring health and wellness to Native people, and demonstrate how Indian culture has and is continuing to enrich our worlds. An Evening with Wisdom of the Elders, its second annual gala, is planned for Friday, June 21st, at 6:30 p.m. in the Rose Ballroom of the Ainsworth Event Center in Southwest Portland. The featured guest and keynote speaker will be Deanna D. Dart, Ph.D., curator of Native American art at the Portland Art Museum. Cedar Rose will perform a collaborative musical effort that focuses on traditional and contemporary Native American sounds formed by Karen Kitchen and Nico Wind. More information about this KABU-sponsored event may be found at kabu.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KABU program is made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Dr. Robert Amajoy and the Northwest Center for Colorectal Health, LLC, providing screening colonoscopy to help prevent colorectal cancer as well as minimally invasive management of colorectal disease. Offices in Portland and Milwaukee. Detailed information at 503-216-5380 or nwcch.com.
Good morning.
You're listening to KBOO-FM. This is More Talk Radio. My name is Cecil Prescott.
My name is Celeste Carey, and KBOO-FM, Portland. Coming in strong at 90.7 here in the metro area. And we're working on my mic in case I sound ethereal to you.
There you go.
There we go. And it's 104.3 in Philomath and Corvallis, 91.9 Hood River in the Gorge. And on the web, it is kboo.fm.
Let me give you our phone numbers. Our phone numbers are 503-231-8187. And we invite your calls and participation this morning. This morning, we are speaking with Greg Carter, who is an assistant professor of history at the University of Wisconsin,
Milwaukee.
Okay, there we go. There you
go. Okay, that's Greg Carter, assistant professor at the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee, and the author of the book we'll talk about this morning, The United States of the United Races, A Utopian History of Racial Mixing. And we are pleased to have Dr. Carter with us this morning. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. How are you?
I am well. We had the chance to read your book this weekend, and we are excited that you are here this morning with us. I want to preface our conversation with two observations, and one is this month we observed the anniversary of the U.S. Supreme Court decision on Loving decision in 1967, which allowed interracial marriage. One other observation is something that has been popularized on media, social and otherwise, is a breakfast cereal commercial which feature a daughter of a mixed-race couple that got a lot of feedback in social media and Twitter and all of that. All of this is just to say that this has been an ongoing conversation within the United States, in which your book gives us a history of this. And so we thank you for joining us this morning.
Sure.
Perhaps we can begin by you just stating a little bit in terms of clarification in terms of definition in terms of mixed race, multiracial. These are certainly developments in the past decades.
Or biracial.
Mm-hmm. Give us a framework to begin our conversation.
Sure, and then the meanings of these terms?
Yes, and their prominence recently in the United States.
Sure. So I think that a lot of people are familiar with the term multiracial. I think most often in the newspaper, the TV, radio, you hear the term multiracial. I think multiracial became popular starting in the 1990s with the social movement to put some kind of identifier of mixed race identity onto the U.S. Census. So I think that is the term people will most often run across. The term biracial is also very popular. I think I've noticed that often people who are racially mixed, black and white, often use the term biracial. And then I more often than not use the term mixed race. I am not antagonistic to either of those groups or movements, but I think that I'm trying to move myself, position myself more in a more neutral position from their movements. They all three kind of connote the same thing. Individuals who have parents from the more traditional racial groups in their immediate or intimate family.
And so in defining them, are you defining them more as the social construct or is there a political construct, or is it hard to move away from either one of those mindsets?
Mm-hmm. It is rather hard to talk just exclusively about one, whether it be the social construction of race or the political. What I am I'm saying is that these terms have meanings that are historically situated. So, like I said, the term multiracial is very popular since the 1990s, signifying a recent development in identity, a recent and more visible development in identities that racially mixed Americans are embracing. But I think that all of these terms change in time and in place. If you look in the dictionary under biracial or multiracial and so on, just a few generations ago or beyond, you'll see that the term multiracial or the term biracial kind of meant people, for example, a biracial committee would be a committee with black and white people in it. So if you look at these older dictionary definitions, they're not talking about the meanings that we talk about today with mixed folks and identity. They're just talking about, this is a committee with people from two different races in it. So I want to stress that the meanings of these terms are definitely historically situated and change and have changed in time.
Your book is entitled The United States of the United Races, subtitled Utopian History of Racial Mixing, and it gets its title from a writer in the 19th century that you write about in terms of Wendell Phillips. Emphasizing again the long-standing discussion within our country about how we are a country. Tell us a little bit about the title and what prompted you to write the book.
Sure. So I was in graduate school. I was interested in mixed race, and it's very easy to find a lot of the more hateful parts of our history that have banned interracial marriage and punished people for being in interracial relationships. But every once in a while, I came across someone who actually had something good to say about interracial intimacy and who did not seem threatened by it, would even say that it was a positive to the nation. And so I ended up collecting all of these different scraps and then different tidbits. Turned out to be quite a bit, or at least a viable amount of examples to pull together into a narrative. In particular, during the Civil War era, in the period leading up to the Civil War, I started to learn more and more about the abolitionists. And Wendell Phillips was an abolitionist. Many kind of say that he was William Lloyd Garrison's Moses. Garrison was kind of the Aaron. Phillips was renowned as an orator, spoke in public often, wrote many pieces for the newspaper The Liberator. And this particular section of abolitionism was more radical. The New England abolitionists were more radical than many of the others, starting even before the Civil War. As far back as the 1830s, they undertook a campaign to eliminate Massachusetts' law against interracial marriage. And so the abolitionists were we consider them kind of peculiar. They weren't really fighting to marry interracially themselves, but they saw that this law was wrong and racist. They wanted to remove all laws in Massachusetts that referred to race. So this campaign actually went on for a dozen years before it was successful in 1843. And so I started to learn more about that. I learned more about Wendell Phillips. The title of his op-ed is from 1854. And I ran across this, and it's an essay in which he says that it's essentially America's destiny to become mixed, that if we're going to be a multicultural democracy, there will be mixture, and that is not a bad thing. And so in delving more and more into that period, I found that his articulation was especially provocative. And when it came time to title my book, I decided to cop the title of his op-ed from 1854.
And the fact that it may not seem revolutionary today, but certainly when Wendell Phillips wrote this and was promoting his theory about the good thing about of races coming together and intermarriage, it was part of a long debate within the United States of first how do we identify ourselves in terms of European or not, or even among Europeans, and whether or not the question of intermarriage was something good or something bad.
Right.
In your book, focus on individuals and organizations which struggle with these issues throughout the throughout our history. You mentioned Thomas Jefferson, and many of us are familiar with Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings.
Yet he had contradictory beliefs.
Yeah, and I think that says something about our country. Tell us about Thomas Jefferson and his thought on these issues.
Sure. So most of us are familiar with the fact that Thomas Jefferson had a long-standing relationship with his slave, Sally Hemings, had probably six children with her, but only officially freed two of them. He let two run away without really pursuing them. And so this is a large part of his reputation today. But also hand in hand with the fact that he wrote the Declaration of Independence. So dealing with Jefferson is to deal with the contradictions of American democracy. Jefferson did not only once or twice ever mentioned racial mixing in his existing writings. He's very close-lipped about it. But what I saw was that he had peers, even friends and close associates, who held different positions than he did. And so I really wanted to tease that out to show that at any moment in our history, there are varied beliefs and ideas about race and slavery and racial mixing. One of the important things, another reason I examined that period is because I wanted to present the idea that at this moment, very early in our nation's history, that to grapple with the question of slavery or freedom, to grapple with the question of citizenship or not for racially mixed people or minorities, was to grapple was one and the same. So if someone was pro-slavery, they were also had to take the public stance of being against mixture. If one was against slavery, that they often were had a position that was more open to racially mixed people having citizenship, and that would be a way to transition out of slavery as a system.
And certainly some of those who were anti-slavery, many were against interracial marriage and advocated for the separation, even the establishing new colonies in Africa with black slaves.
Mm-hmm. Correct. So Jefferson did have a couple different ideas about abolishing slavery during his long career, and a central in that was that recently freed people should be removed away from the rest of society. And then later, especially at the end of the 18th century, beginning of the 19th century, the American Colonization Society became very popular. And this is a very interesting group. Many of us learn about it in high school, that this was an organization that worked to relocate African Americans back to Africa, to Liberia. What's ironic is that it attracted a wide spectrum of supporters. So you could be pro-slavery and own slaves, but just do not want to avoid uprisings and so on. So you would support the idea of colonizing blacks to Africa. You could be anti-slavery, just want to really abolish slavery and support colonization. You could be anti-slavery, but also a racist and dislike blacks and support the idea of recolonization. But if you look at their founding documents, you see that the question of what to do about racially mixed people was central in their founding proceedings.
You're listening to More Talk Radio here on your Community Connection, KBOO Portland. I'm Celeste Curry. I'm here with Cecil Prescott. We're interviewing Greg Carter, who is the author of The United States of the United Races, A Utopian History of Racial Mixing. In listening to you describe the different scenarios that one could have in either embracing or rejecting the idea of racial mixing, of emancipation versus slavery, et cetera, to me it almost sounds as though the various members of each camp or whatever camp were trying to figure out political ways of having their cake and eat it too, which amounts to basically just saying we still need to support and perpetuate the idea of white supremacy and white political power in the country.
Mm-hmm, right. So it was very possible to still be in support of white supremacy, yet support the American Colonization Society. There's such a wide variety of motivations and positions that were especially active before the Civil War, and I think they're different now, but I think that's the way our society is to this day.
So that would move us to your third chapter in the book, which is Plessy versus mm-hmm. racism. Mm-hmm. So can you kind of connect how you chose that particular dynamic and that point in history as kind of the poster event for that political ideology of protecting white political power and supremacy as it moved into the next century?
Right, right. Well, I was familiar with the history of Creoles of color mm-hmm. in Louisiana, and I was familiar with the Plessy versus Ferguson Supreme Court case, which ultimately the Supreme Court decided their decision essentially supported racial segregation. So I delved into that and wanted to learn more. There's a misconception that the Creoles of color in Louisiana were only looking out for themselves, that they were trying to protect their whatever benefits they had from a near white appearance and whatever privileges they had in their society. I the more I delved into the topic and the era, the more I learned that that's wrong, that in fact the Creoles of color who brought forth the Plessy versus Ferguson case really had were really looking to upend not just segregation, but also white supremacy and the very practice of racial classification for the sake of classifying and putting people into certain positions in society altogether. They wanted to do away with these things altogether. And so even though they were not formally connected to the abolitionists of the Civil War era, their intellectual work and their foundations were definitely built upon many of the ideas of the radicals of the Civil War era, and the man that they chose to be their main attorney, Albion Tourge, mm-hmm. had been a Civil War officer and also had a radical background. So this was really a campaign and a hope and a movement to call into question racial classification, injurious racial classification altogether.
And just to put it in a larger context, it's somewhat difficult for us again to imagine what that was like, over 100 years ago in terms of this one case, but. What makes it also difficult is in terms of how powerful race played and continues to play a role, but just in terms of racial classification. So that when one talks about the effort to keep the races separate, it meant in part classifying those who ancestors who might have had one great-grandparents who might have been of African descent classified not as white but as Negro.
Mm-hmm.
And you speak also in terms of the challenge of what that meant in terms of either citizenship and or participation in our democracy or in our society. Tell us something about that in terms of how people view themselves, how they classify themselves, and how they assume different roles, whether one assimilated or passed, or what were some of those struggles about?
Sure. First, I'll talk about the Creoles of color in particular, but then I'll move on to talk about other racial groups at the time. So the Creoles of color had racial mixture in their background, and that was kind of a central part of their identity. At the same time, like I said, there's a misconception that Creoles of color were all looking to be white and to preserve their white identity. I think that's generally wrong. There's an entertaining story from the 1850s, in which a Creole of color woman, she was the lover of a white man, and someone in town had said that she was not white, and she went to court to and said that this was slanderous. And she ended up losing her court case because the state of Louisiana kept detailed genealogies of people, and so it was really foolhardy for her to try to say that she was white, because you could just go to City Hall or what have you and find the genealogies. She became the butt of many jokes in the Creole community. They really disliked what she was doing, because they knew that they could not be white in the American sense.
In the larger political arena.
Right, of being pure and white. They knew they had white ancestors, but they knew what the American system was like. They knew that they could not be racially pure and purely white. So she became kind of the butt of many jokes. So the Creoles of color, many of them, like I said, they knew they had mixture. They knew that they some of them may appear as white, but they also knew that they could not be white, purely white in the American sense. Not all of them had this kind of radical sense. Some of them did. Some of them were descendants of refugees from Haiti, from the Haitian Revolution, and had this idea of what one scholar has called public rights, that your civil rights, your social, that your civil rights, your social rights, your political rights are all bound up in one, in public rights. And this is an idea that they baked into the state of Louisiana Constitution in 1868, shortly after the Civil War. So at the same time that the radical Republicans in Washington were making changes towards racial equality, down in Louisiana, this group of Creoles of color were doing the same. They saw all of these things together as a part of your rights and your equality, so your ability to move about in public was just as important as your ability to vote and what have you. So this is the group of Creoles of color who were the main protagonists behind the Plessy versus Ferguson case. I also argue that at the same time, people, those who cared about racial equality in the U.S., were conscious of what was going on in other regions of the country.
Mm-hmm.
So they were conscious of what was happening to former Mexicans in the Southwest. They were familiar with what was happening to Asians who had come to the U.S. to work, and the oppression of Asians in the U.S. So I argue that the Creoles of color doing the Plessy case had a sense that what they were doing was really important for all groups of people. We often learn U.S. history from the East Coast towards the West, and we learn about slavery first. But I think that there are cases in our history that may have had African Americans at the center, but that were actually relevant to more groups of people. So the folks fighting fighting against segregation in Louisiana had all of these other regions and peoples in mind.
You're listening to More Talk Radio here on KBOO-FM. The phone number is 503-231-8187, and we'll go to our patient caller. Good morning, Joanne. Good morning.
We'll try again with Joanne. We invite your calls, particularly those who are come from multiracial families, to talk about your experiences and what that means to you. Again, our numbers are 503-231-8187. We're speaking with Greg Carter, the author of The United States of the United Races. As you talk about this, you ended just then about sometimes we think of history moving from the East towards the West. I wonder if you could expand the conversation a little bit more, because you do so in your book. You mention those Mexico, also those who native population and immigrants from Asia, the Pacific. How do we incorporate those stories in our national narrative?
Right. Well, I think it's important to fit in, to kind of think of the U.S. as porous, and it's challenging because you're trying to teach a class, you're trying to teach U.S. history, and we all have to deal with that life seems rather linear itself, so how do we tell the story of the U.S.? I think somehow it's really important to fit in the Southwest, it's really important to fit in Asian laborers. I found that in teaching the antebellum period, I always make a point of teaching the Texas Revolution, that much of the Southwest had been part of the of Mexico, Mexico had invited American entrepreneurs to build businesses. Many of those American entrepreneurs went to Texas. Some intermarried, some were did not intermarry, but were building business interests there, and joined in partnership with the Tejanos, the Mexicans in that region, to break free from Mexico more broadly. Break away from the country of Mexico. Ultimately, they did after the Texas Revolution, and started their own republic. Ultimately, the leaders of the new Texas Republic did want to make it a slave state. Did want the U.S. to annex Texas, and so that's what ultimately happened. But what happened in the Southwest after the war was that there was the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, which dictated the terms of the surrender, and in the treaty it promised citizenship to the Mexicans in the territory that was brought into the United States. But as we've seen through the Southwest and through the racial oppression of people of Mexican descent, that promise was not really kept. So much of the history of Mexican Americans has been about the failure to keep that promise, a promise that said that they would qualify as white, but the realities are that darker, poorer Mexicans would not qualify as white. And in general, with U.S. expansion into the Southwest, Americans kind of took the land from just about any kind of Mexican in the Southwest. At the same time, laborers were coming in from China, the feeling that they were a threat to the job market grew. The idea that they would racially mix grew. And so we had the Chinese Exclusion Act in 1882. And for Native Americans, we have the long history of removal, violation of treaties and what have you. I think in particular, in terms of racial mixing in Native Americans, an important moment was the Dawes Act of the late 1800s, which really bolstered the system of blood quantum. Mm. So for Native Americans, there's a fascination, or not really fascination, the centrality of measuring out your genealogy in fractions. Mm-hmm. When you think about it, seems really kind of retrograde and backwards, archaic. But so on one hand, it helps dole out some reparations. On the other hand, historically, it has led to the removal of land or the taking of land. On one hand, it bolsters Native American and tribal identities, but on the other hand, it really encourages or discourages outmarriage.
What it essentially did is it just really codified and kind of crystallized Theodore Roosevelt's beliefs, which is, as you mentioned in the book, imperialist expansion, racial hierarchy, robust patriarchy, and then promoting the U.S. as a quote-unquote liberal democracy that could bestow equality on people. Mm. And I did separate of all nations out, but only because when it bestowed the rights of citizenship within our boundaries, it still did it according to that particular formula, which once again just supported the whole idea of white supremacy and white political power. We want to kind of fast forward here to the beginning of a public racial shift. Mm-hmm. Of consciousness. And I'm going to jump forward to Tiger Woods, because he, again, was another one of those poster moments, because there was a certain expectation of his racial identity that was both thwarted and realized in the popular consciousness. Mm-hmm. Can you speak to us how you saw that as a transitional moment in both embracing cultural contributions of different people of color outside of the black-white dichotomy?
Mm-hmm. Well, I am going to back up just a little
okay.
very quickly.
Okay.
I think that looking at the whole picture, I think that the growth of the term the melting pot was a really important moment.
Yes, yes.
So the melting pot was a play by Israel
Zangwill
from the early 20th century that on one hand, it said that intermarriage and mixing was part of the making of the American. And so this was not a brand new idea. You can see this earlier in the different chapters of my book. Mm-hmm. But what I think that the main thing about the melting pot play was that it gave Americans a way to talk about intermarriage and mixing in a positive way. And it wasn't just the melting pot alone. Social scientists of the time were also building a rhetoric of the melting pot and that we are a melting pot. I think that this is a really important moment and a really important development, because then regular Americans could have a way of thinking about it, thinking about intermarriage as not just bad and repugnant and so on. So I think that bit at the beginning of the 20th century really informs the later 20th century, as well as all of the developments of the century, the social movements, and so on. So we get to the 1990s, and we've had the civil rights movement and all of that. Tiger Woods has his huge successes in 96, 97, and he really becomes a poster boy for many things, and some have even said he was kind of a poster boy for just about anything. African Americans were very proud, Asian Americans were very proud of the achievements of Tiger Woods. A lot of thinkers on race said, "Well, this is proof that we've kind of reached our goal of equality." And individual talent, because look at how talented Tiger Woods is and how successful he is. This couldn't have happened however many generations ago. And on the other hand, conservatives also embrace Tiger Woods as a symbol of individual talent and merit, and that hard work and not what they might call handouts will lead to success. So on part of Tiger Woods, the phenomenon of Tiger Woods revolved around these dynamics.
You're listening to KBOO FM. This is More Talk Radio. I'm Cecil with Celeste. Our guest this morning is Professor Greg Carter, The United States of the United Races, A Utopian History of Racial Mixing is his book. Let me remind you that coming up here on KBOO at 9 on the Omo Variety Hour, sociologist Charles Derber talked about how and why young people are becoming more skeptical about consumerism. Also, a Left and the Law segment about Edward Snowden, Bradley Manning, and classified information, and a review of a book about the lives of people in the weather underground. At 10, Air Cascadia is off. Instead, we'll get an update on Iran's election. At 10:15 on Locus Focus, host Barbara Bernstein speaks with Julia DeCord, Northwest organizer for Food and Water Watch, which is closely monitoring and protecting approval of GE salmon by the FDA, about the imminent danger of genetically modified salmon poised to appear at your local supermarket. At 11, it's Health and Healthcare Forum. Roberta Hall speaks with Dr. Melinda Manoa, Professor of Nutrition and Exercise Sciences at Oregon State University, about energy balance research and application. She also interviews four participants in a recent session at the Pauling Institute, which does research and teaching on nutrition, micronutrients, and health. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a KBOO member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Now. Our numbers here are 503-231-8187. You were just speaking, Professor Carter, about the movement and ended up with Tiger Woods. I want to go back again to the 60s again. And in your book, you talk some about the movements for inclusion of different racial groups. Say something about what was happening in the 60s in terms of racial identity and how people identify themselves, and then perhaps we can move on in terms of the utopia vision that some people had.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So many of the social movements that allow for us to brought about the great changes and advances took place in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. If you follow these stories, you kind of know that by the 60s, some of the movements really moved into a kind of what's called cultural nationalist position. So Black Power, Brown Power, Yellow Power, so on. So the way these things are taught, we're usually taught that the Civil Rights Movement was led by seemingly moderates like Martin Luther King, and that by the late 60s, the younger generation was fed up with the kind of patient, nonviolent way and the assimilationist way, and that they kind of took the forefront. In some ways, this is a simplistic analysis that kind of puts down the previous generation. But in any case, the more cultural nationalist movements of the 60s were very antagonistic towards racial mixing and put down intermarriage, group members who would intermarry or what have you, and that their actions were a threat to the race, whether that be African American or Latino Hispanic or even somewhat Asian Americans, these movements are kind of known for their kind of rigidity in mm-hmm. that matter.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 here. You can make a call and contribute to the conversation at 503-231-8187. Having dealt with some of the political gathering that we experienced, I kind of want to take a trip down a cul-de-sac. You made mention of it in your introduction, and I found it really an interesting statement, and I just kind of wanted to unpack it because it kind of connects, in a sense, the popular consciousness and rise of consciousness toward the idea of a multiracial world, a global community. And that was your reference to consumer DNA tests and how, interestingly enough, they have recast the tension between the idea of a pure and a mixture of races. And so people are looking at their personal genomics and recovering family histories and looking at the way that sometimes they have not moved very far from where their ancestors are and have not really broadened racially. And then other terms, they find themselves pretty far flung.
Right. So there are these consumer genomics tests where you can send in a sample of your cells, and they'll break down your DNA using the human genome database and match patterns in your DNA to patterns that appear in different parts of the world. These parts of the world are parts of the world that we think of as racially, I guess, racially pure, whether it's African or Asian or what have you, Northern European or what have you. And then mail the results back to the consumer, and then the on one hand, it does disrupt the way people think about their identity, that they may not be as pure as they think they are. On the other hand, it can kind of reinforce the ideas that they already had about their identity. I think that we all tend to find reason and try to incorporate new findings into the understandings that we already have. I think that part of the appeal of this is that people can say, "Wow, I am rather mixed," and so some people do celebrate that and are happy to find that news. I think that this reaction kind of ties into the idea of America as mixed and new and unique that many of the speakers and thinkers in my book have spoke about from the very beginning, from the 18th century. On the other hand, it can be rather superficial.
Mm-hmm.
So at the end of my book, in the conclusion, I run down a sort of checklist for evaluating statements about racial mixing. And then from day to day, we have encounters where people say, "Oh, in the future, everyone will be mixed," or, "Oh, your kids are beautiful because they're mixed." And I put this kind of superficial statement at one end of the spectrum, a very kind of low-level praise of racial mixing. And then I offer several steps in the middle, and then the fifth level that I describe are includes people who really had a reforming, I guess, radical or reforming vision of the United States, and then so the main speakers in my book, I put Wendell Phillips there. Mm-hmm. I put the Creole of Color who brought forth the Plessy case. I put forth some of the activists around the multiracial movement in the 1990s. So these are people who really wanted to reform society towards a more equal way. For them, they did have this position of defending racial mixing, but it wasn't just for itself. It wasn't just to have this idea of, or this vision, or this fantasy of America being mixed and tawny and ambiguous and beautiful in the future. They really wanted to reform all of society, and that defending racial mixture, being comfortable with racial mixture, was just part of a larger vision of reform that they were really working towards.
In a vision of a quote-unquote post-racial world, do you see the dismantling of a political hierarchy so that people can really embrace the idea of the strength of biological diversity? Or do you see us kind of living in this ambiguous state of limbo wherein we kind of accept the biodiversity and the strength, but there are lingering threads of racial hierarchy?
I see it more as the latter. When I try to grapple with some of these ideas, especially when I try to grapple with some of the more racist ideas, and I sometimes they still seem to come up in day-to-day conversations and in the news and in politicians' statements, I kind of think of racial thinking. In some ways, racial thinking in the United States has been kind of like a wall in an old house that you've painted a number of times, and that each of the layers of new paint does not completely conceal what comes out, what was underneath. The previous layers, the previous materials, still poke through, still kind of show their colors. So when we have new ideas and we have new social movements, or when the new ideas become, or when ideas become more popular, racially mixed people become more visible and accepted, that alone does not mean that everything has changed. We still have vestiges of old ways of thinking with us. For regular people, not the scholars of race and so on, everyone just kind of cobbles together their meanings in really contradictory ways. You might be open-minded about some things. You might know about DNA, that the perceived differences, racial differences that exist between different humans, boils down to about what point 0.01% of our DNA. You might know these things. At the same time, you might make statements where you generalize and imply stereotypes to different groups of people. So I think we're all rather contradictory when it comes to racial thinking, and so we still see vestiges of outmoded ways of thinking from our past.
We've been speaking with Dr. Greg Carter, professor of history at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. I commend to you his book, The United States of the United Races, A Utopian History of Racial Mixing. We would like to have you on again, Dr. Carter, to continue this conversation. And thank you for your book and for taking the time to be with us this morning.
Indeed.
Sure. Thank you very much for including me.
This is your Community Connection, KBOO Portland, and we welcome your thoughts and ideas, input, conversation online as well. You can find Cecil and myself at kboo.fm/moretalkradio. Drop us a line, give us your thoughts. We welcome the conversation. In the meantime, stay tuned to your Community Connection. We have more good information for you here, right here on KBOO Portland.
Peace, this is Mike Crenshaw. I want to invite you to come out to see Long Distance Revolutionary, a documentary about Mumia Abdul-Jamal. This film chronicles his life as a revolutionary, a writer, a journalist, a philosopher, and an inspiration to people worldwide. It's showing June 14th at the Clinton Street Theater. That's a Friday night.
At 7 p.m.
That starts the week-long run of Long Distance Revolutionary in Portland. KBOO is proud to bring you this event, and I hope to see you there.
And that's one of the things that constantly surveilling people and constantly communicating to them that they're powerless before this omnipotent government corporate institution does to people. It convinces them that the tiny little box in which they live is really the only box in which they want to live, so they no longer even realize they're being imprisoned. Rosa Luxemburg put that best. She said, "He who does not move does not notice his chains."
That's Glenn Greenwald on the Surveillance State on the Next Alternative Radio. The award-winning journalist and lawyer Glenn Greenwald recently broke the story of NSA contractor turned whistleblower Edward Snowden. Hear Glenn Greenwald on the Surveillance State on Alternative Radio this Tuesday at 9 a.m. on KBOO Portland.
I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are tuned to KBOO 90.7 FM here in Portland. And it's 9:01, time for the Old Mole Variety Hour. The name of this show comes from Karl Marx's image of the mole as the revolution, that force of the people that works below the surface of society to undermine its foundations and then erupts unexpectedly to challenge the old order of things. This show supports the efforts of ordinary people to get to the roots of the conditions that oppress them and to fight for radical change. I'm your host for today, Clayton Morgridge. Joe Clement is our engineer. Well, on today's show, we'll be hearing about how young people today are increasingly skeptical about one of the legs on which modern capitalism